Chapter 34. A figure grew to flickering solidity within Zodiacal Light's imaging tank. Clavain, Remontois, Scorpio, Blood, Cruz, and Felka sat in a rough semicircle around the device as the man's form sharpened and then took on animation. "Well," Clavain's beta level said, "I'm back." Clavain had the uneasy sense that he was looking at his own reflection flipped left to right, all the subtle asymmetries of his face thrown into exaggerated relief. He did not like beta levels, especially not of himself. The whole idea of being mimicked rankled him, and the more accurate the mimicry, the less he liked it. "Am I supposed to be flattered," he thought, "that my essence is so easily captured by an assemblage of mindless algorithms?" "You've been hacked," Clavain told his image. "I'm sorry." Remontois leaned towards the tank and spoke. "Volyova stripped out large portions of you. We can see her handiwork, the damage she left, but we can't tell exactly what she did. Very probably all she managed was to delete sensitive memory blocks, but since we can't know for sure, we'll have to treat you as potentially viral. That means that you'll be quarantined once this debriefing is over. Your memories won't be neurally merged with Clavain's, since there's too much risk of contamination. You'll be frozen onto a solid-state memory substrate and archived. Effectively, you'll be dead." Clavain's image shrugged apologetically. "Let's just hope I can be of some service before then, shall we?" "Did you learn anything?" Scorpio asked. "I learned a lot, I think. Of course, I can't be sure which of my memories are genuine and which are plants." "We'll worry about that," Clavain said. "Just tell us what you found out. Is the commander of the ship really Volyova?" The image nodded keenly. "Yes, it's her."
"And does she know about the weapons?" asked Blood.
"Yes, she does." Clavain looked at his fellows, then back to the tank. "Right then, is she going to hand them over without a fight?"
"I don't think you can count on that, no. As a matter of fact, I think you'd better assume she's going to make matters a little on the awkward side."
Felka spoke now. "What does she know about the weapon's origin?"
"Not much, I think. She might have some vague inkling, but I don't think it is a great interest of hers. She does know a little about the wolves, however."
Felka frowned. "How so?"
"I don't know. We never got that chatty.
We'd better just assume that Volyova has already had some tangential involvement with them, and survived, as I need hardly point out. That makes her at least worthy of our respect, I think. She calls them the inhibitors, incidentally. I never got to the bottom of why."
"I know why," Felka said quietly.
"She may not have had any direct involvement with them," Remontois said. "There is already wolf activity in this system, and must have been for some time. Very probably all she's done is make some shrewd deductions."
"I think her experience goes a little deeper than that," Clavain's beta level answered, but made no further elaboration.
"I agree," Felka said.
Now they all looked at her for a moment.
"Did you impress on her our seriousness?" Clavain asked,
turning his attention back to the beta level. "Did you let her know that she would be much better off dealing with us than the rest of the conjoiners?"
"I think she got the message, yes."
"And?"
"Thanks but no thanks," was the general idea.
"She's a very foolish woman, this Volyova," Remontois said.
"That's a shame. It would be so much easier if we could proceed in a cordial manner, without all this unfortunate need to use aggressive force."
"There's another matter," the simulated Clavain said. "There's some kind of evacuation operation in progress. You've already seen what the wolf machine is doing to the star, gnawing into it with some kind of focused gravity wave probe. Soon it will reach the nuclear burning core, releasing the energy at the heart of the star. It will be like drilling a hole into the base of a dam, unleashing water under tremendous pressure. Except it won't be water. It will be fusing hydrogen at stellar core pressure and temperature. My guess is that it will convert the star into a form of flamethrower. The core's energy will be bled away very rapidly once the drill has reached it, and the star will die, or at least become a much dimmer and cooler star in the process. But at the same time, I imagine the star itself will become a weapon capable of incinerating any planet within a few light hours of Delta Pavonis, simply by dousing that arterial spray of fusion fire across the face of a world. I imagine it would strip the atmosphere from a gas giant,
and smelt a rocky world to metallic lava. They don't necessarily know what will happen on Resurgam, but you can be certain that they wish to get away from there as soon as possible. There are already people aboard the ship, airlifted from the surface. A few thousand at the very least.
And you have evidence of this, do you?
Asked Scorpio. Nothing I can prove, no.
Then we'll assume that they don't exist. It's obviously a crude attempt at convincing us not to attack.
Thorn stood on the surface of Resurgam, his coat buttoned high against the harsh polar wind that scraped and scoured every exposed inch of his skin. It was not quite what they would once have called a razor storm, but it was unpleasant enough when there was no nearby shelter. He adjusted flimsy dust goggles, squinting into starlight, looking for the tiny moving star of the transfer ship. It was dusk. The sky overhead was a deep velvet purple, which shaded to black at the southern horizon. Only the brightest stars were visible through his goggles, and now and then even these would appear to dim as his eyes readjusted to the sudden flash of one of the warring weapons. To the north, and reaching some way to east and west, soft pink auroral curtains trembled in invisible wind. The light show was only beautiful if one had no idea what was causing it, and therefore no grasp of how portentous it was. The aurorae were fueled by ionized particles that were being clawed and gouged off the surface of the star by the inhibitor weapon. The inwards bulge, the tunnel that the weapon was boring into the star, now reached halfway to the nuclear burning core. Around the walls of the tunnel, propped apart by standing waves of pumped gravitational energy, the interior structure of the star had undergone a series of drastic changes as the normal convective processes struggled to adjust to the weapon's assault. Already the core was beginning to change its shape as the overlying mass density shifted. The song of neutrinos streaming out from the star's heart had changed tune, signifying the imminence of the core breakthrough. There was still no clear idea about exactly what would happen when the weapon finished its work, but in Thorn's view, the best they could do was not hang around to find out. He was waiting for the last of the day's shuttle flights to finish boarding. The elegant craft was parked below him, surrounded by a throbbing insectile mass of potential evacuees. Fights broke out constantly as people struggled to jump the queue for the next departure. The mob revolted him, even though he felt nothing but admiration and sympathy for its individual elements. In all his years of agitation, he had only ever had to deal with small numbers of trusted people, but he had always known it would come to this. The mob was an emergent property of crowds, and as such he had to take credit for bringing this particular mob into being, but he did not have to like what he had done. Enough, Thorn thought. Now was not the time to start despising the people he had saved, simply because they allowed their fears to surface. Had he been amongst them, he doubted that he would have behaved with any great saintliness. He would have wanted to get his family off the planet, and if that meant stamping on someone else's escape plans, so be it. But he wasn't in the mob, was he? He was the one who had actually found a way off the planet. He was the one who had actually made it possible. He supposed that had to count for something. There, sliding overhead, the transfer ship crossed his zenith and then dove into shadow. He felt a flicker of relief that it was still there. Its orbit was tightly prescribed, for any deviation was likely to trigger an attack from the surface-to-orbit defense system. Although Kuri and Volyova had dug their claws into many branches of government, there were still certain departments that they had only been able to influence indirectly. The Office of Civil Defense was one, and it was also one of the most worrying, entrusted as it was with the defenses to prevent a recurrence of the Volyova incident. The office had rapid-response surface-to-orbit missiles equipped with hot-dust warheads, designed to take out an orbiting starship before it became a threat to the colony as a whole. The Ultra's smaller ships had been able to duck and dive under the radar nets, but the transfer shuttle was too large for such subterfuge. So there had been brokering and behind-the-scenes leverage, and the result was that the office's missiles would be held in their bunkers, provided that the transfer ship, or any of the trans-atmospheric shuttles, did not deviate from rigidly defined flight corridors. Thorn knew this, and was confident that the various ships' avionic systems knew it too, but he still felt an irrational moment of relief every time the transfer ship came into view again. His portable telephone chimed. Thorn fished the bulky item from his coat pocket, fiddling with the controls through thick-fingered gloves. Thorn. He recognized the voice of one of the Inquisition House operators. Recorded message from Nostalgia for Infinity, sir. Shall I put it through to you, or will you take the call when you are in orbit? Put it through, please. He waited a moment, hearing the faint chatter of electromechanical relays and the hiss of analog tape, imagining the dark telephonic machinery of Inquisition House moving to serve him. Thorn, it's William here. Listen carefully. There's been a slight change of plan. It's a long story, but we're moving closer to Resurgam. I'll have updated navigation coordinates for the transfer ship, so you won't have to worry about that. But now we may be looking at much less than 30 hours round trip. We might even be able to get close enough that we don't need to use the transfer ship at all. Just bring them straight aboard Infinity. That means we can accelerate the surface to orbit flights. We only need 500 rounds of shuttle flights, and we've evacuated the entire planet. Thorn, suddenly it seems as if we might have a chance. Can you arrange things at your end? Thorn looked down at the brewing mob. Curry appeared to be waiting for him to reply. Operator, record and transmit this, will you? He waited a decent interval before responding. This is Thorn. Message understood. I'll do what I can to speed up the evacuation process when I know that it makes sense to do so. But in the meantime, might I inject a note of caution? If you can reduce the 30 hours round trip, great. I endorse that wholeheartedly. But you can't bring the starship too close to Resurgam. Even if you don't succeed in scaring half the planet out of their skins, you'll have the Office of Civil Defense to worry about. And I mean, worry. We'll speak later, Anna. I have work to do, I'm afraid. He looked down at the mob, noting a disturbance where all had been quiet a minute earlier. Perhaps a little more than I feared. Thorn told the operator to send the message and alert him if a reply was forthcoming. He slipped the phone back into his pocket, where it lay as heavy and inert as a truncheon. Then he began to scramble and skid his way back down towards the mob, kicking up dust as he descended. Clear of zodiacal light, Antoinette.
Good, she said. I think I can start breathing again.
Through the flight deck windows, the light hugger still loomed enormously large, extending in either direction like a great dark cliff, chiselled here and there with strangely mechanistic outcrops, defiles, and prominences. The docking bay Stormbird had just cleared was a diminishing rectangle of gold light in the nearest part of the cliff, the huge toothed doors already sliding towards each other. Yet even though the doors were sealing, there was still adequate room for smaller vessels to make their departures. She saw them with her own eyes and on the various tactical displays and radar spheres that packed the flight deck. As the armored jaws slid towards closure, small skeletal attack ships, little more than armored trikes, were able to slip between the teeth. They zipped out, riding agile high-burn antimatter-catalyzed fusion rockets. They made Antoinette think of the mouth-cleaning parasites of some enormous underwater monster. By comparison, Stormbird was a sizable fish in its own right. The departure had been the most technically difficult she had ever known. Clavain's surprise attack demanded that zodiacal light sustain a deceleration of 3 Gs until its arrival within 10 light seconds of Nostalgia for Infinity. All the attack ships in the current wave had been forced to make their departures under the same 3 Gs of thrust. Exiting any spacecraft bay was a technically demanding operation, most especially when the departing ships were armed and fuel-heavy. But doing it under sustained thrust was an order of magnitude more difficult again. Antoinette would have considered it a white-knuckle job if Clavain had demanded that they exit at a half-G, the way rim pilots arrived and departed from Carousel New Copenhagen. But 3 Gs, that was just being sadistic. But she had made it. Now she had clear space for hundreds of meters in any direction, and a lot more than that in most. Cut in tokamak on my mark, ship. 5, 4, 3, 2, and mark. Through years of conditioning, she tensed, anticipating the tiny thump in the seat of her pants that always signified the switch from nuclear rockets to pure fusion. It never came. Fusion burn sustained and steady. Green across the board. 3 Gs, Antoinette. She raised an eyebrow and nodded.
Damn, but that was smooth.
You can thank Xavier for that. and perhaps Clavaine. They found a glitch in one of the oldest drive management subroutines. It was responsible for a slight mismatch in thrust during the switch between thrust modes. She switched to a lower magnification view of the light hugger, one that showed the entire length of the hull. Streams of makeshift attack craft, mostly trike-sized, but up to small shuttles, were emerging from five different bays along the hull. Many of the craft were decoys, and not all of the decoys had enough fuel to get within a light second of Nostalgia for Infinity. But even knowing that, it still looked impressive. The huge ship appeared to be bleeding streams of light. And you had nothing to do with it. One always tries one's best. I never thought otherwise, ship. I'm sorry about what happened, Antoinette. I'm over it, ship. She couldn't call it Beast anymore, and she certainly couldn't bring herself to call it Lyle Merrick. Ship would have to do. She switched to an even lower magnification, calling up an overlay that boxed the numerous attack craft, tagging them with numeric codes according to type, range, crew, and armament, and plotted their vectors. Some idea of the scale of the assault now became apparent. There were around 100 ships in total. 60 or so of the 100 were trikes, and about 30 of the trikes actually carried assault squad members, usually one heavily armored pig, although there were one or two tandem trikes for specialist operations. All of the crewed trikes carried some form of armament, ranging from single-use grazers to gigawatt-yield Breitenbach Bosers. The crew all wore servo armor. Most carried firearms, or would be able to disengage and carry their trike's weapon when they reached the enemy ship. There were about 30 intermediate-sized craft, two- or three-seater closed-hull shuttles. They were all of civilian design, either adapted from the ships that had already been present in Zodiacal Light's holds when she was captured, or supplied by H from his own raiding fleets. They were equipped with a similar spectrum of armaments as the trikes, but also carried the heavier equipment, missile racks and specialized hard docking gear. And then there were 9 medium to large shuttles or corvettes, all capable of holding at least 20 armored crew, and with hulls long enough to carry the smallest kind of railgun slug launchers. 3 of these craft carried inertia suppressors, extending their acceleration ceiling from 4 to 8 G's. Their blocky hulls and asymmetric designs marked them as non-atmospheric ships, but this would be no handicap in the anticipated sphere of combat. Stormbird was much larger than the other ships, large enough that its own hold now contained 3 shuttles and 12 trikes, along with their associated crews. It had no inertia suppression machinery. The technology had proven impossible to replicate en masse, especially under the conditions aboard Zodiacal Light. But by way of compensation, Antoinette's ship carried more armaments and more armor than any other ship in the assault fleet. It wasn't a freighter now, she thought. It was a warship, and she had better start getting used to the idea.
Antoinette?
Yes, she asked, gritting her teeth.
I just wanted to say, now, before it's too late.
She hit the switch that disabled the voice, then eased out of her seat and into her exoskeleton.
Later, ship. I've got to inspect the troops.
Alone, with his hands clasped tightly behind his back, Clavaine stood in the stiff embrace of his exoskeleton, watching the departure of the attack ships from an observation cupola. The drones, decoys, trikes, and ships gyred and wheeled as they left Zodiacal Light, falling into designated squadrons. The cupola's smart glass protected his eyes against the savage glare of the exhausts, smudging the core of each flame with black so that he saw only the violet extremities. In the distance, far beyond the swarm of departing ships, was the brown-gray crescent face of Resurgam, the whole planet as small as a marble held at arm's length. His implants indicated the position of Volyova's light hugger, though the other ship was much too distant to see with the naked eye. Yet a single neural command made the cupola selectively magnify that part of the image, so that a reasonably sharp view of Nostalgia for Infinity swelled out of darkness. The Triumvir ship was nearly 10 light seconds away, but it was also very large. The 4-kilometer-long hull subtended an angle of a third of an arc second,
which was well within the resolving capabilities of Zodiacal Light's smallest optical telescopes. The downside was that the Triumvir would have at least as good a view of his own ship. Provided she was paying attention, she would not be able to miss the departure of the attack fleet. Clavain knew now that the Baroque augmentations he had seen before, and dismissed as phantoms added by the processing software, were quite real, that something astonishing and strange had happened to Volyova's ship. The ship had remade itself into a festering Gothic caricature of what a starship ought to look like. Clavain could only speculate that the melding plague must have had something to do with it. The only other place he had seen transformations that even approximated what he was seeing now was in the warped, phantasmagorical architecture of Chasm City. He had heard of ships being infected with the plague, and he had heard that sometimes the plague reached the repair and redesign machinery, which allowed ships to evolve. But he had never heard of a ship becoming so thoroughly perverted as this one, while still, so far as he could tell, being able to continue functioning as a ship. It made his skin crawl just to look at it. He hoped that no one living had been caught up in those transformations. The sphere of battle would encompass the 10 light seconds between Zodiacal Light and the other ship, although its focus would be determined by Volyova's movements. It was a good volume for a war, Clavain thought. Tactically, it was not the scale that mattered so much as the typical crossing times for various craft and weapons. At 3 Gs, the sphere could be crossed in 4 hours, a little over 2 hours for the fastest ships in the fleet. A hyperfast missile would take fewer than 40 minutes to span the sphere. Clavain had already dug through his memories of previous battle campaigns, searching for tactical parallels. The Battle of Britain, an obscure aerial dispute from one of the early transnational wars, fought with subsonic piston-engined aircraft, had encompassed a similar volume from the point of view of crossing times, although the three-dimensional element had been much less important. The 21st century's global wars were less relevant. With suborbital wave-rider drones, no point on the planet had been more than 40 minutes away from annihilation. But the solar system wars of the latter half of that century offered more useful parallels. Clavain thought of the Earth-Moon secession crisis, or the battle for Mercury, noting victories and failures and the reasons for each. He thought of Mars, too, of the battle against the conjoiners at the end of the 22nd century. The sphere of combat had reached far above the orbits of Phobos and Deimos, so that the effective crossing time for the fastest single-person fighters had been 3 or 4 hours. There had been time-lag problems, too, with line-of-sight communications blocked by huge clouds of silvered chaff. There had been other campaigns, other wars. It was not necessary to bring them all to mind. The salient lessons were there already. He knew the mistakes that others had made. He knew also the mistakes he had made in the earlier engagements of his career. They had never been significant errors, he thought, or he would not be standing here now. But no lesson was valueless. A pale reflection moved across the cupola's glass. Clavain. He snapped around with a whir of his exoskeleton. He had imagined himself to be alone until then. Felker, he said, surprised. I came to watch it happen, she said. Her own exoskeleton propelled her towards him with a stiff, marching gait, like someone being escorted by invisible guards. Together they watched the dregs of the attack squadron fall into space. If you didn't know it was war, he began. It would be almost beautiful, she said. Yes, I agree. I'm doing the right thing, aren't I? Clavain asked. Why do you ask me? You're the closest thing I have left to a conscience, Felker. I keep asking myself what Galliano would do if she were here now. Felker interrupted him. She would worry, just as you worry. It's the people who don't worry, those who never have any doubts that what they're doing is good and right. They're the ones that cause the problems. People like Skade. He remembered the searing flash when he had destroyed Nightshade. I'm sorry about what happened. I told you to do it, Clavain. I know it was what Galliano wanted. That I should kill her. She died years ago. She just didn't end. All you've done is close the book. I removed any possibility of her ever living again, he said. Felker held his age-spotted hand. She would have done the same to you, Clavain. I know it. Perhaps. but you still haven't told me if you agree with this. I agree that it will serve our short-term interests if we possess the weapons. Beyond that, I'm not sure.
Clavain looked at her carefully. We need those weapons, Felker.
I know. But what if she, the Triumvir, needs them as well? Your proxy said she was trying to evacuate Resurgam.
He chose his words. That's not my immediate concern. If she is engaged in evacuating the planet, and I've no evidence that she is, then she has all the more reason to give me what I want so that I don't interfere with the evacuation.
And it wouldn't cross your mind to think for a moment about helping her?
I'm here to get those weapons, Felker. Everything else, no matter how well-intentioned, is just a detail.
That's what I thought, Felker said.
Clavain knew that it was better that he say nothing in answer. In silence, they watched the violet flames of the attack ships fall towards Resurgam and the Triumvir's starship. When Curry had finished responding to Thorne's latest message, she arrived at a troubling conclusion. Walking was even harder than it had been before, the apparent slope of the floor even more severe. It was exactly as Ilya Volyova had predicted. The captain had increased his rate of thrust, no longer satisfied with a mere tenth of a G. By Curry's estimation, and the Clavain beta level agreed with her, the rate was now double that, and probably climbing. Previously horizontal surfaces now felt as if they were sloping at 12 degrees, enough to make some of the more slippery passages difficult to traverse. But that was not what was concerning her.
Ilya, listen to me. We have a serious fucking problem.
Volyova emerged from contemplation of her battlescape. The icons floated within the squashed sphere of the projection like dozens of bright frozen fish. The view had changed since the last time she had seen it, Curry was certain.
What is it, child?
It's the holding bay, where we have the newcomers.
Continue.
It's not designed to deal with the ship moving under thrust. We built it as a temporary holding bay, to be used while we were parked. It's spun for gravity so that the force acts radially, away from the ship's long axis. But now that's changing. The captain's applying thrust, so we've got a new source acting along the axis. It's only a fifth of a G at the moment, but you can bet it's going to get worse. We can turn off the spin, but that won't change things. The walls are becoming floors.
This is a light hugger, Curry. This is a normal transition to starflight mode.
You don't understand, Ilya. We've got 2,000 people crammed into one chamber, and they can't stay there. They're already freaking out because the floor is sloping so much. They feel as if they're on the deck of a sinking ship, and no one is telling them anything's wrong.
She paused. She was a little out of breath.
Ilya, here's the deal. You were right about the bottleneck. I told Thorne to get things moving faster at the Resurgam end. That means we're going to be getting thousands of people arriving very soon indeed. We always knew we'd have to start emptying the holding bay. Now we'll just have to start doing it a bit sooner.
But that would mean...
Volyova appeared unable to complete the thought.
Yes, Ilya, they're going to have to get the tour of the ship, whether they like it or not. This could turn out very badly, Curry. Very badly indeed.
Curry looked down at her old mentor.
You know what I like about you, Ilya? You're such a frigging optimist.
Shut up and take a look at the battle display, Curry. We are under attack, or we will be very shortly.
Clavain?
The merest hint of a nod.
Zodiacal Light has released squadrons of attack craft, around 100 in total. They're headed here, most of them at 3 Gs. They won't take more than 4 hours to reach us, no matter what we do.
Clavain can't have those weapons, Ilya.
The Triumvir, who now looked far older and frailer than Curry ever remembered, shook her head by the barest degree.
He isn't going to get them. Not without a fight.
They exchanged ultimatums. Clavain gave Ilya Volyova one last chance to surrender the Hell-class weapons. If she complied, he would recall his attack fleet. Volyova told Clavain that if he did not recall his fleet immediately, she would turn the 13 remaining weapons against him. Clavain readied his response.
Sorry. Unacceptable. I need those weapons very badly.
He transmitted it, and was only slightly startled when the Triumvir's answer came back 3 seconds later. It was identical to his own. There had not been enough time for her to see his response.